Hi, can you hear me? Can you hear me all right? Yeah, great. Just going to wait for that to come up. My name's Sharon, as Kay introduced me. I'm going to be talking about cognitive hypnotherapy and the alignment between unconscious and conscious minds and how they could be doing separate things, different things to what you want. All I mean by the unconscious is that automatic part of your mind that beats your heart, keeps you breathing, keeps you blinking, digests your food. So it's just that. So that's the definition that we'll be using for this. So why I'm doing this, I was diagnosed with unprovoked pain, certainly from the classical model of pain, it was unprovoked. Now it's seen more as a functional disorder, which is a disorder, some rewiring issue in the brain. I was diagnosed in 1999 with the whole group, I suppose, vestibular dynia, vaginismus, vulvar dynia, and various other issues. And as my pain increased, I had to stop working because I started fainting from the pain. And I spent a good few years at home, not doing very much really, trying out different therapies, until I discovered self-hypnosis in 2007, and I managed to break through the pain. It wasn't something I particularly believed in. I didn't know there was any science behind it, and I'm more scientifically minded. But it was only when my friends pointed out to me that I seemed to be up and about and living my life again that I had to revisit what had happened. And I investigated further and went on to train. So I've been living comfortably for the last 5 years. And I'm not the only person who's managed to do this through hypnosis. I'm a member of the International Association for the Study of Pain, so I'm particularly interested in producing an evidence base for cognitive hypnotherapy techniques with the and how efficient it is in treating conditions like vulval pain. The Quest Institute is where I trained in Regent's College. We've already conducted some practice-based research to determine the impact of cognitive hypnotherapy on well-being, and we're in the process of publishing that data, and we're going to present it to the Royal Society of Medicine next month. So next, yes, we'd like to do a pilot study into chronic pain, and hopefully into vulval pain. I've got a couple of helpers with me today. Helen, who's up there, if you make yourself known. Helen, under the classical model, had provoked pain caused by a couple of bouts of throat cancer. She now manages her symptoms and empowers others. She's also the specialist for chronic pain at the National Council for Hypnotherapy. My other helper is Zeenat, who's over there in the corner. She was diagnosed with an autoimmune disorder, which left her with body pain and inflammation. Her prognosis was that she'd be in a wheelchair by 40. She's not in a wheelchair. She's walking around absolutely fine. So I just wanted two other people to show you that it's not just me who's got better. There's evidence out there. We just need to build more. So cognitive hypnotherapy should be seen as a complementary therapy, to sit aside other things, perhaps like medication or physiotherapy, whatever works for the individual, and that will vary depending on how you experience your own pain. We pull together knowledge from various areas, so from current neuroscience, from cognitive theory, evolutionary psychology, the emerging field of psycho-neuroimmunology, and we use techniques from various disciplines. Again, we tailor the approach depending on the individual person and their needs and the way that they use their brain. Now, hypnotherapy is not for everyone. Certainly, if you're hoping to go and see a cognitive hypnotherapist and you're hoping for them to fix you, then this probably isn't the approach for you. It is a collaboration between the therapist and the patient so that you better understand the processes that are going on, the biological processes that might be going on, and how the mind actually creates some of that and how you perceive pain. And tasking is part of that journey as you start understanding how things are working within you. So I've got some key definitions here. You've probably heard of trance, and you might have a picture of a hypnotist putting you in a trance and waving a pocket watch in front of your eyes. If you're expecting that, you're going to be disappointed. That's not going to happen. Trance, as we describe it in cognitive hypnotherapy, are everyday states of mind. So, for example, time distortion is a particular type of trance when you might have read a book and been so engrossed in it, or been watching a TV program and be so into it that you don't realize time flying by, and you look up and you realize, wow, how quickly time's gone by. That's time distortion, that's a type of trance. In pain, some people may experience their pain in a type of trance like time distortion. So when they're in pain, they're noticing the time going really, really slowly. So we would utilize that particular trance state if that's the trance the person might be in when they experience the pain. Another trance state is negative hallucination. I won't go through all the trance states, there's far too many of them, but just a few. Negative hallucination is when you don't quite pick up on what is there right in front of you or within you. So you might be noticing all the negative things that are going on in your life, or the negative sensations, the uncomfortable sensations you might be feeling, as opposed to the times when you might be feeling comfortable, because we don't tend to notice those things. Again, we would utilize that trance if that was an indicator of what was going on. Age regression is this thing where we replay past events, and this is a common one with pain conditions, because we tend to replay lots of times when we've been in pain. So each time we're in pain, our brain quickly replays all the other times. We've got this huge neural network, and if that's the trance that's going on, we will use that regression technique to change that. Age progression, for some of you, I think we do this quite a lot. We're very good at rewinding, going to the past and looking at things that didn't work out so well. And age progression is fast forwarding into the future and looking at the consequences of things. If I have sex, I'll probably end up in pain. Various beliefs surrounding that. We do this, and we do it usually very, very quickly. Just fast forwarding to something that's not going to be particularly positive for us. And sensory distortion is a big one, because that's to do with us noticing the pain symptoms as opposed to all those times when we might be feeling better. And there's lots more. Hypnosis then is actually just a method that we use to guide you into that trance state, whichever trance state you might be using when pain is particularly bad. We would use hypnosis to guide you in. This is not about the therapist being in control. It's more about you learning how to hypnotize yourself. And in fact, all hypnosis is self-hypnosis. Stage hypnosis is very different to the therapeutic approach, and there's a lot you don't see when it comes to stage hypnosis, where people have been primed for certain reactions. So cognitive hypnotherapy utilizes those same trance states that make you perceive pain, and essentially we're dehypnotizing you from that trance. And it's about you taking control of your mind. The definition of pain that I know some of the speakers have touched upon, this is the part of the definition that the International Association for the Study of Pain uses, is that pain is an unpleasant sensory and emotional experience associated with actual or potential tissue damage, or described in terms of such damage. Now, this is quite an important definition because it brings in the sensory component that we tend to be aware of, but it also gives us that emotional experience because that's how it's coupled together. We have an emotional experience. And when we talk about emotion, we're talking about the biological reaction that's going on within us. So emotions are biological reactions. Could be adrenaline or cortisol dropping into your system. And it talks about actual or potential damage. So there doesn't have to be damage there. So in terms of functional pain, or what is currently called unprovoked pain, there might be nothing to see there, but somehow that pain is still being caused. There's still some kind of biological reaction happening. So perhaps the word provoked isn't such a kind word, because actually all pain is provoked, whether it's something that's obvious or whether it's something biological or emotional. I've got quite a bit to fit in today, so I'm going to flip through some slides. I'm going to skip through them, but we may come back to this one and look at placebo, nocebo, pessimists and optimists. But I hope that you're starting to understand through today that thoughts and beliefs actually cause these chemical reactions to happen. So if I were to ask you who's running you, is it your conscious or your unconscious? And you were to look at this diagram, and the orange bit represents one part of your mind and the grey bit represents another part. Which do you think has more power? Which do you think takes up that orange area that really runs your body? Yeah. Your conscious thinking, aware mind is responsible for very little. We have this illusion that we run our body. Thoughts and beliefs do affect an emotional reaction and pain. However, if we look at the orange section, that's your unconscious automatic mind that sorts through quite a lot of processes, and I'll come on to all the stuff that it does in a moment. So, if we look at this quote from Albert Einstein, knowledge is limited, imagination is everything, it's the preview of life's coming attractions. For us, it's quite important that when someone comes to see a cognitive hypnotherapist, that you have an idea of what it is that you want, what it is, what change you want in your life, because without a focus of attention, then where might we be going? It's like turning up in a country you don't know, you've been plonked in the middle of the desert, without a map to get to somewhere. How do you know where you're going? So we need a focus of attention. So if I'm hoping people generally have pens and pieces of paper. So I want you to have a think about what you want, to start building or creating or imagining this compelling vision of how you want to experience life in a better way. Now, doing this is involving this ability we have to fast forward. So we're fast forwarding into the future. But the one thing this can do, although because we want you to be in the present, but fast forwarding into the future and defining what it is that you want can then help you come back to the present and notice the things within the present moment that might already be starting to take you in that direction. So if you want to just take a moment or two to jot down what it is that you want out of this, and any partners, you can utilize this as well for where you want to be. It doesn't have to be about pain. It could be wherever you want to be. Add in some sensory evidence for how you'll know you're better, because our brain works in a sensory way. So what are the things you will see that'll be different once you're better? What might you hear? How might you feel? And what might you be doing? So I wonder whether you've had a chance to kind of get started on that. And you might have more ideas come to you as we go through this. So I don't know whether you've heard of the concept of the blue tree. Well, I've turned it into a blue elephant because I like elephants better. But if I were to ask you not to think of a blue elephant, so whatever you do, don't think of a blue elephant. I know you can see him, but if you close your eyes and I ask you not to think of that blue elephant, what happens? Blue elephant, yeah, exactly. So, actually, when we phrase things in terms of what we don't want, our mind doesn't really process it that way. When we say we don't want pain, we do not want pain, our unconscious mind kind of takes out the not, its focus is on the pain. It goes to, rather than do not, I do not want pain, it takes out the not and ends up with, I do want pain. So the blue elephant is just there to focus your mind on that not. So if ever you do come across a blue elephant, you know not to think of it. So I wonder, as some of you have been writing down your vision for the future, whether Nelly, the blue elephant, has crept in, whether any of you have written down, I don't want to be in pain, or anything like that. And if you have, just to allow yourself to reword that, so that you're going towards what you want, not running away from what you don't want. So, the concept of mental filters, various therapies call them different things, but mental filters, we have about 2 million bits of information coming through our senses in any one moment. And we all have a unique way of filtering all of that information. Because if I were to ask you, none of us here can be aware of those 2 million bits of information. In fact, if you take in everything around you, the texture of the carpet down here, the exact shade, the texture of the chairs you're sitting on, the feeling of the clothes upon your body, where your hands might be resting. If you're wearing glasses, how they might be feeling on your nose. Our unconscious mind filters all of this information through preferred senses. Some of us prefer our visual sense more than our auditory sense. For some people, it's something they see that might set off a chain reaction. For others, it might be a tone of voice. For others, it might be something they feel or perceive to see. So what happens to these 2 million bits of information? Because actually, at the end of it all, we're the conscious mind, the aware part of our mind, is presented with very little. About 134 pieces of information get through to our conscious mind. Because if we had 2 million bits of information and we have that hitting our senses and we were aware of it and we needed to consciously process that information, it probably take us our whole lifetimes to process the moment of our birth. So it's just not feasible. So we've adapted to use particular things. Our unconscious mind deletes a whole load of information. So, as I mentioned, how's your right big toe feeling, or your left earlobe? you're not aware of the sensations of those until I bring your attention to it. So if you look at this picture of the lady up there, and I don't know whether any of you may have seen this picture before, and whether as you look at that picture, whether you can see an old lady or a young lady. How many of you see the old lady? Okay. And how many of you see the younger one? Ah, right, okay. And how many of you can flip between the two? Right. How many of you can only see one or the other? Right, okay. So, the young lady is looking over her right shoulder and wearing a choker around her neck with a feather in her hair. And I can see some of you screwing up your faces for this one. You will get it. The older lady has a rather prominent nose, and she's kind of shuffling her head into her collar of a fur-like coat. So this is how we manage to delete information. Both sets of information are there, but our brain may choose to focus on one rather than the other. And actually, we can't see both at exactly the same time. Even if you're aware of both of them being there, you might flip from one to the other. So this again is how our mind deletes information. So what else might you be missing if this is the case? I suppose the question is with people with pain is, what are the things in the present that you might be missing or your unconscious mind might be deleting that might actually be useful for you to realise, either taking you towards a goal or in the moments where you're feeling comfortable? And if you're noticing that you're going towards a particular goal, such as your vision for the future, and you actually notice that, you'll get a hit of dopamine, which can alleviate pain. So quite important for us. And if you're deleting things like indicators when someone is loving you, or someone is behaving in a way that means you can trust them, and you're not allowing yourself to feel that love, then you might be missing out on oxytocin, which again is a pain alleviator. The other tool our mind uses, our unconscious mind uses to sort through the pain is distortion. We experience what we expect to experience until we reach something called the difference threshold, until something tips us over the edge for us to actually sit up and take notice. So if someone would have a really little hair trim, and you saw them, you might not pick up on that. But if you saw them and they'd shaved their whole head off, hair off, or their head off, you'd probably notice. So the difference threshold within pain, we would look at getting you to assess your pain levels, perhaps on a 1 to 10 scale, perhaps on another scale, but let's say a 1 to 10 scale, to assess what level of pain you might be at in one particular situation. And after using something like cognitive hypnotherapy or whatever else has happened, to reassess so you notice the difference. So if you were to look at this, and I wonder how many of you notice something odd about it as you read those. The first one reads Paris in the spring. Once in AA lifetime. Bird in the hand. It's So we're distorting the reality. It's right in front of us, but our mind, our unconscious mind, has chosen to distort it to give us what we expect. If we expect pain, then we're going to get it. If we expect to see the right thing up there, we'll see it. So we use that 1 to 10 scale so you notice that difference. Our mind is also good at generalizing. And it generalizes things to fit in with the beliefs that you have. So one of the beliefs I used to have when I used to have vulval pain was a belief that drinking alcohol caused my pain. And it was a really strong belief. So whenever I went out with my friends, I knew to expect that I'd be in pain the next day, because I was exacerbating or amplifying my symptoms in some way. Actually, that didn't turn out to be true. It's just that my unconscious mind was noticing all the things in my environment that might have triggered my pain. And all your mind does is take a snapshot of reality. Memory isn't total. Memory is just a snapshot of a meaning we gave to something at the time, how we might have processed it at the time, whether we saw the old lady or the young lady, whether we saw what we expected to see. It's just a generalization. And the other generalization might fit into the A equals B. So my colleague up there, Zeenat, she had a belief when she was in pain that when it rains, my body's in pain. She's a fascinating one, so that living in England, unsurprisingly, she was in pain quite a bit. So again, using cognitive hypnotherapy, we managed to challenge that generalization. And cognitive hypnotherapy is there to recover some of the deletions and distortions that our mind might be making that aren't helpful for us. So the cognitive hypnotherapy framework, although we utilize various therapies within our framework, so CBT, NLP, Gestalt theory, human givens approach, we utilize what's useful for the client, but the framework is rigid. So we're looking for the context within which you might experience your pain. We're looking for those generalizations. We're looking for those distortions. We want to pinpoint what the difference is that might make the difference for you. The structure is the trance states you might be using that amplify your pain, or the trance states within which you notice your pain a lot more. And we look at the building blocks of pain perception. We'll probably be doing an exercise on that later, so we'll come back to that. The process we use maps the moment, from the moment the stimulus that you might feel, whether that might be a dermatological issue or something else, right through to, I'm just going to fast forward so you can see this. Stimulus is the external or internal environment that acts as the trigger. Now, that's usually an unconscious thing that happens. You may not be aware of it initially as being a stimulus. So wherever that nerve, that peripheral nerve, is sending up a signal, up from wherever it is, the vulva, or if it's referred pain, you might have backfiring pain to the vulva and going up to the brain, up the spine. It ends up at the brainstem, goes up to the thalamus, and the thalamus distributes this message, which at the moment is not a pain message, is a danger alert message. It's like, danger, something might be going on here. The brain then splits it up into its component parts and sends it off to different areas of the brain. Now, we're only starting to understand how so many different parts of the brain are involved in amplifying pain symptoms. But what happens, part of what happens certainly, is that your mind is looking for that pattern match. It's looking for that cause and effect. This is causing my pain, or this has happened, therefore it equals pain. So it goes into our matrix of memories to find a pattern match for our current experience. That's an unconscious process. Then we might feel an emotion, which again is an unconscious process. We don't usually think, I want to feel this, and then go on and feel it. Although thoughts can affect emotion, it does work the other way. But in this model, we're looking at emotion happening first, which then goes on to the reaction, which might be avoiding using the area, doing anything at all. It might be getting angry or going into fight or flight mode, or being sad or depressed or frustrated. And that goes from unconscious to the conscious process, noticing how far down the conscious process is. Noticing again who's in control here. And then at some point that process finishes and your mind evaluates the whole process, usually unconsciously, to go, ah, now is that belief justified? So going back to my belief that alcohol caused pain, my brain would have been going, ah, yeah, I think it was the alcohol that caused that pain. And it just stores that memory away. So that over time, with each thing that happens, another memory is built up and that network grows. So this belief that my alcohol consumption might be causing my pain is growing. So quickly, I won't go into too much detail about this, but we've got a number of protective systems in place. Our unconscious mind is ultimately, well, our mind is ultimately a protector. It protects us, it wants us to survive. It's there to make sure we're kept out of danger and we're going towards comfort. So we've got a number of systems that work for us, like the endocrine system, the immune system, the sympathetic nervous system, and the parasympathetic nervous system. All of them doing great jobs for us. But with some of them, if there's an excess use of them, can then produce a hypersensitivity for that danger alert signal. So just going back to that danger alert signal that goes from perhaps the vulva or elsewhere, up the spine and up to the brain. At this point, you're not feeling pain. We go into the memory matrix. Something happens there where pattern matches are found. Is this time like the last time? Might this activity induce pain? Everything goes back to the thalamus. And when that information gets back to the thalamus, there's 80% more information than when that danger alert signal first went up the spine. What's that 80% extra information? It didn't come from our senses, it came from our brain. That 80% extra information are the memories that we have and the meaning we've given to those memories. So if we have a load of memories associated with certain things causing pain, that's what's being relayed back to the thalamus. And then from there is decided whether a pain signal is sent down or whether an alleviation signal is passed down. This is a diagram used by a doctor called Graham Brown, who treats chronic pain, mainly a specialist in chronic back pain. And it just illustrates the overflow effect of adrenaline and cortisol over time. Both of these are obviously necessary for us to perform particular functions. But over time, this drip-drip effect that goes into the system, if it's not utilized, because essentially adrenaline is designed to make us run from danger, i.e. ancestors running from a predator, or fighting for our lives, fighting a predator. But if we've got a drip-drip effect over time, no amount of exercise is going to dispel a whole load of adrenaline that's just dripping in over time. And adrenaline isn't really designed to be dripped in over time. It's usually in the system for no more than an hour and then out again. But if we have this drip-drip effect, at some point, this bathtub will overflow. And that bathtub just represents your body. And at the point it overflows, the analogy is that it drips over into you feeling that pain. So fight responses, familiar phrases you might hear yourself saying. I know before I was diagnosed, I had a year of doctors telling me all sorts of things, a bit like as if it was all in my head. And I used to have this feeling of, you know, this anger. You know, it's not all in my head. Funnily enough, you know, I find out that the pain signal is caused by the brain. But that wasn't really explained to me, and I was just very angry about it. Why don't they understand the pain I'm in? It's another one you might have. And another one is this stubbornness to do as many things as possible on a good day. And what we have is this pattern of doing so many things on a good day that it sends us right back down to that pain symptom cycle again. Flight, when we're running away from the pain. So things like, I won't wear tights, seem sensible, right? You know, I certainly wouldn't wear tights when I was in pain. I'm happily wearing one that sucks everything in today, because I can now. But just so that you realise that this is a flight response, running away from this. I won't touch that area. Again, making ourselves hypersensitive to pain. As we're fleeing from the pain, adrenaline and cortisol are dripping into our system, making our system hypersensitive. Again, I won't have sex. I'm going to ignore it. Ignoring it is an interesting one, because if you have lots of time on your hands and you're pretending to ignore it, what have you done with it? You've kind of hidden it under something, but it's still there, isn't it? Distraction is different to avoiding it completely. The freeze response, the giving up phrases, it's hopeless, there's no point, there's no cure. No one's ever going to get better from this. I'm not going to get better. I'm going to have this over a lifetime. I'm always going to be in pain. And I'm not going to do any physical activity or whatever it is until the pain stops. So these are classic freeze responses. So brain scans suggest, and when I talk about brain scanning technology, we've learned quite a lot over the last 30 years, but we've only touched on a tiny portion of it. So what I present here today is based on what we know right now, but in 10 years' time, we might know something differently. So this is the best that we know at the moment. So brain scans are suggesting that hypnosis interrupts that chemical message, that danger alert message going up the spine, before it reaches the brain. It also suggests that it changes the processing of the signal in different areas of the brain. So a different response is sent down the spinal cord. So instead of a pain response being sent down the spinal cord, you have a different response. So it can lessen that pain perception or start muting the sensation. So here are some of the different areas that it's a whole brain, pain is a whole brain experience. So these are just some of the areas. The amygdala is a part of the brain that's involved with our memories that have a particular emotional charge. And I know the gentleman there talked about traumatic events. And actually, when we do regression techniques with people, we find traumatic events, but perhaps events that seem traumatic to a child may not seem traumatic to us now. And actually, as a child, aged about 7, we've kind of made up our mind about where we are in the world. And yet we know that a child of 7 is pretty much in black and white thinking mode. They're not going to have the reasoning capabilities, the knowledge that we have to process an event accurately. And also when we uncover memories using hypnosis, to remember that memories are not actual things that happened back then, but just a snapshot of how it was recorded at the time. with the generalisations we made at the time, with the distortions, with the filters that we used. The anterior cingulate cortex is another area involved in the pain matrix, and things like distraction and visualisation help with that. There's quite a few studies going on with burns victims at the moment. You may have seen a few in the news with people wearing these kind of headsets, the virtual reality headsets, taking them off to a distracting place. And these severely burned victims reported that they didn't feel the pain whilst they were accessing this virtual reality game or visualization. Now, we don't have snazzy virtual reality headsets in cognitive hypnotherapy. We just work with your imagination, the imagination that you have. The prefrontal cortex, one of its many roles is that it mediates sleep. And we find that with chronic pain and vulval pain, that sleep patterns can often be interrupted. People may not fall off to sleep straight away. They might have heightened sensitivity at that point, or they might wake up in the night. So again, hypnosis can get you to understand how your body relaxes so that you can drift off into sleep. The insula, which deals with perception, we, using hypnosis, serve to change particular perceptions you may have. So again, working on the generalizations you may have. So, I've run through that pretty quickly. Before we go on, I wonder whether you have any questions, people have any questions, because the next part is going to be filled with a practical workshop. So relaxation techniques and a visual technique that I want you to take away with you to see how it helps to improve your symptoms. Thanks, Kay.